This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Live from Sketchfest in San Francisco, you're listening to The West Wing Weekly, presented by Audible. I'm Hrishikesh Hirway.
And I'm Joshua Malina.
Today we're talking about episode 17 of season 2. It's called The Stackhouse Filibuster.
The teleplay is by Aaron Sorkin. He's very good. The story is by Pete McCabe, old friend of mine for 30 years. Pete McCabe, applause. Pete was a staff writer on Sports Night. He was not a staff writer on The West Wing, yes, but he explained to us on the phone yesterday that there was a WGA, Writers Guild, rule that you have to have two scripts a season written by someone who's not on the writing staff. So he was brought in by Aaron after Sports Night was canceled, and he pitched the idea of a filibuster episode, Pete cleverly realizing that there was just baked-in conflict in a filibuster. Aaron took the idea and ran with it, and we're also going to discuss with our guest how he had influence on the story. This episode was directed by Brian Gordon. It first aired on March 14th in the year 2001.
Here's a synopsis. You ready for a synopsis?
Yes. Live read Rishi. You're going to find out how much editing usually goes into this.
I hastily wrote this before the show started, and it ends in a pun.
Oh, it's a rhinopsis.
It is. Okay. The senior staff are ready to head out of town for the weekend as soon as a bill called the Family Wellness Act gets passed. It should pass without a hitch, but an elderly senator holds an epic filibuster. The vice president steps up to admonish the oil industry, a move that puzzles Toby, and the whole night might have been cursed by the Egyptian cat goddess Bast, thanks to CJ's breaking a porcelain cat statue, a diplomatic faux pas.
I wanted to mention director Brian Gordon is a great director who directed the Draft Day Part 1, It Can't Rain in Indian Wells episode of Sports Night. I also wanted to point out that we're in SF, Rishi, San Francisco, to discuss SF, the Stackhouse Filibuster. Which makes me wish that we had done a live show in Puerto Rico when we did a proportional response.
Next time. We're going to be joined by a special guest right now.
Woo! We have good news and bad news.
The good news is it's Brad Whitford.
The bad news is it's not the guitarist from Aerosmith. It's the other Brad Whitford. He's a two-time Emmy winner and fan favorite. He's easy on the eyes from the balcony anyway. Brad Whitford.
Also joining us is apparently Brad's breakfast.
Yes.
Also, for those listening at home and not at the live event, Brad threw a rubber hand at me as soon as I entered on stage. Also, the rustling you heard earlier was Rishi and I taking off our shirts. We want to give the live audience a sense of how we generally record the show.
Brad, as Josh mentioned, you were instrumental in shaping what the story for this episode actually was, right?
Well, I was influential. I wouldn't say instrumental. I had been working, a dear friend of mine named John Shestack and his wife Portia heroically started an organization called Cure Autism Now. Their son Dove was diagnosed with severe autism in the 90s, and they were shocked to realize how behind research was how there was not an awareness of this explosion of autism happening. So John did a number of amazing things, one of which was working on the Children's Health Act in 2000. So West Wing had come on, and it was kind of my first experience as celebrity lubricant.
Check out his merch table after the show.
And it was fascinating, and I was able to sort of... Kevin Falls was working on the show at this point, was he not? I believe it was through Kevin that I was talking about this experience with autism. It's tricky. How do these things get funded? Specific diseases. A tricky thing with autism is that, you know, beloved celebrities don't come down with it. And funding can very often go in a very sort of slapdash way to these different issues. One funny story is the NIH with a big bill really does not want any earmarks in terms of exactly how much money they are going to be allotted to study a specific disease. It's very difficult to get an earmark. And at one point, we were up on the hill, and we had hit a number of roadblocks. And the glorious Rene Russo was with us, and we sent her into Ted Kennedy's office in a short dress, and we got right through.
So how did you bring that to Aaron? Is that like a...
You know, I don't remember. I remember feeling very strongly with Aaron, when somebody's writing like that, don't talk to them. Just, you know, let them go do it. I was not somebody who wanted to overtly influence those things. But when they came to ask about it, I just had a lot of information about it. I think it was primarily through Kevin Falls that I got it there.
We've heard from a lot of people when we mentioned that we were going to be talking about this episode, that before we dive into the actual episode itself, a lot of people's reaction to this episode has been very strong. We got a few notes from people who have children with autism, mm-hmm. and they told us about how meaningful it was for them. First, I wanted to play a clip. Here we go.
Hi, Josh and Rishi and West Wing Weekly fans. My name is Dee Perkins, and I couldn't let the Stackhouse filibuster go by without telling you my story. Back in March of 2001, I was sitting in a hotel room in Baltimore, and I was tracking down another experimental treatment for autism with my six-year-old son, Taylor. I was a huge fan of the show and never missed an episode. And little did I know that that night, it would be the first time I would hear the words autism on television. Back in 2001, there was little on the internet except message boards and parents trying to find answers to the diagnosis that robbed them of their children's lives. I was one of those desperate parents, and I saw my little boy retreat into a world of blank stares, hand flapping, and the only words that made sense to him, which were, a clue, which was yelled by Steve back on the show, Blue's Clues. I sobbed that night, running into the hotel bathroom, trying to stay quiet because my son was sleeping in the same room. Aaron had reached out over TV, and he felt my pain. And to this day, I still cry. You can hear it now. Even though I've seen the show 20 times, and I'm an expert at that show, seeing Stackhouse standing there reminded me of my dad, who took trips to Baltimore with me and never said a word when Taylor would only eat McDonald's chicken nuggets. Don't mess with the grandfathers. I have no question, just the hope you would pass this on to Aaron, that the good news is 16 years later, my son works in a restaurant at Tully's here in Syracuse. He's a prep cook. He's not recovered, but he can handle small conversations and he can chop up onions, celery, and carrots better than me. Words make a difference. Rishi, Joshua, Aaron, they gave me the strength to keep fighting and get my son back into this world. So thank you so much for my favorite television episode of all time, the Stackhouse Filibuster.
My name is Mark Bernardin. I am the film editor for the Los Angeles Times. I first saw the Stackhouse Filibuster when it aired in March 2001. At the time, I had been married for a couple of years, and it was a ritual for my wife and I to watch West Wing as it aired. when I first saw this episode, it was just, oh, okay, I get it. And hey, the gang is coming to this guy's aid. That's awful sweet. It wouldn't be until 2002 that I did have my first child, a girl, Sophie, who in 2005 was diagnosed with autism. And it realigns the way you look at the world and the way you look at life and the way you look at art. And so this episode, when I first saw it, was a totally fine, wonderfully done episode of The West Wing. But then seeing it 10 years later, 12 years later, 14 years later, which is now how old my daughter is, it's gained a resonance over the course of time. You know, every time I watch this episode, it feels as if the cast of The West Wing, the crew of The West Wing, the staff of The West Wing, by the end of this episode, they rallied together to help an old man help me. And this episode will always hold a special place in my heart for that reason.
Thank you, Mark. Do we jump in?
Let's jump in.
So, interesting thing about this show, this episode rather, it's a new framework from Aaron, a new expository framework.
For The West Wing, not necessarily for Aaron.
That's true. Aaron had written an epistolary episode. That doesn't usually happen. The expository framework of this episode, of course, is a series of letters, or rather emails, written by the staff to their parents. There is an episode of Sports Night called Dear Louise, in which my character Jeremy writes an email or a letter, who remembers, to his deaf sister Louise. We also tied in, remember, that Marley Matlin, having seen that episode, wanted to play the role, although we never ended up seeing her on camera on Sports Night. She ended up working on The West Wing. In any event, we have Donatella's, we have ENN, the Exposition News Network, which sometimes tells us the information we need. We have DJ Exposition.
Teledonna's.
What did I say, Donatella's? Mm. All right. What else? DJ Exposition, mm-hmm. CJ Exposition. In any event, everybody's writing a letter home. Something that actually...
I found it totally bizarre, not having seen this in a long time. All of a sudden, I'm talking. And I'm like, it's a scene where I'm going into Leo's office. You come back from a commercial break. And I hear my voice, and I'm like, oh, God, you're acting so badly. You don't... Suddenly, I'm writing a letter to my mom. Out of nowhere. I'm not criticizing, I'm just saying it.
Sounds like criticism.
okay.
And Aaron will listen to this. I noticed there's some funnily convenient things about this episode. One, that everyone decides to write an email so they can tell us stuff. And two, that this group of people are heroes on the show who normally are incredible workaholics and all they want to do is stay at work. Suddenly tonight, during the filibuster, everybody has plans.
Even right? Even Toby is like going to a spa somewhere. Like, this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen. The weirdest thing too, and I don't know if I'm jumping in, but you guys are dying. the funniest thing about this episode is the MacGuffin of the press deadline. Like, she's keeping the staff there for the press deadline. It's effective, and again, I'm not criticizing.
So if you're scoring at home, that's two not criticisms.
Yeah, the print deadline is what they're up against. And
But it's like the papers in Casablanca. It's like, what are they? You know, what is this deadline?
Yeah. Right. I'm not criticizing Casablanca, but that part was really bad. I think we're going to play a clip shortly.
Yeah.
This is something else I noticed, and maybe I'm wrong, but I think there's a weird time warp. CJ is writing her email early on, and before the theme even plays, we're going to give you the clip in a minute, she's writing about, I think you're going to come around and start to like this guy, which she can only know at the end of the episode after all sorts of things have happened, right? So it's a weird time.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting, and again, I'm not criticizing. Because it is so... Honestly, when I look at these episodes, I am truly, honestly, I'm not being defensive or ironic, absolutely just stunned that anybody could write like this. But I did notice, you know, It's like, here's where, you know, here's where we're going to go.
Did you like Citizen Kane? Was that good enough for you?
No, I thought Butterfly, the thing with Pia Zadora, was better.
Okay, now we know. Right, we're going to play a little clip, but yeah. Also the clip leads into the West Wing theme, which we want to give you in its entirety. And if you are listening to the show, does any of you watch the West Wing or listen to our podcast? Yeah. Rishi told a very sweet story about when he was younger and first watched the show performing some sort of dance move to the opening swell. So, I'm wearing my Hanukkah socks. I think we're going to give it a shot if you can explain to us again how to do it.
So, my sister and I used to watch on DVD, and that was our first experience binge watching. And my bedroom was at the end of the hall, and the living room was on the other end of the hall. And so she would start the next episode to try and get me to come out. And eventually it became a thing where I would run down the hall and then slide in front of the TV as the theme came on. So the
not
first note
in just
the
little white underpants. It should
no,
be noted.
I did not do full risky business. And then we would, yeah, dance move is generous. It's really just like a flourish. With the first note, the
let's give it a shot.
Okay. I'm afraid my socks are not slippery enough, but let's see.
So the press is in the briefing room, the staff's in the West Wing, and I'm right here. I'm betting when you read this, you're going to be glad I stayed. I'm betting you're going to end up rooting for a Minnesota senator named Howard Stackhouse. Because I got to tell you, this doesn't seem like any old filibuster.
That was fun. Pretty sure I got a splinter, but.
By the way, oh.
You can talk over. You hate the theme anyway.
Not to criticize, but ugh, this theme.
No, it just occurs to me, am I William Shatner, like?
You wish.
Opening? Talking about a show that ended.
Oh, great. Now he's taking shots at the entire endeavor. A 4.5 year podcast we've dedicated ourselves to.
No, and one thing I do want to say, I think it's terrifying for all writers. I think Aaron would have been paralyzed. Oh,
you like him. He likes you.
No, no, no.
It's covered.
If he knew that we were examining this over and over.
He is a big fan of the podcast and a big friend of the podcast. He gave us an amazing interview.
I think he loves it. No, I'm just saying, as a writer, to think that in 20 years, people are going to be...
No one's going to be
talking about
looking at your writing. In 20 years, they're still going to be talking about Aaron's writing.
Okay.
Can I get some information, basic information about filibuster into the record?
Yes, please.
So for anyone who needs a refresher, a filibuster is essentially, correct me if I'm wrong, because I usually am, a sanctioned form of obstruction. It's allowed in the Senate, not in the House, which has time limits, right? The idea being that a senator can delay or in fact even prevent a vote on a piece of legislation or on a presidential nominee. That has changed a little. I'll get to that in a minute. Filibuster can only be overridden by 3/5, a supermajority of sworn senators, which normally is 60. That's called cloture. Good.
Cloture.
We know that in 2013, the Democratic majority in the Senate, they invoked the nuclear option, which now doesn't apply to legislation, but it means you can have a simple majority for a presidential nominee other than the Supreme Court.
And Trump took it literally.
This is likely going to bite them in the ass very shortly. Then I want to tell you one quick little story about the longest filibuster ever. Apparently, it was sustained by Senator Strom Thurmond.
Strom Thurmond.
Yes. HBO, are you watching? I would watch that movie. Senator Strom Thurmond, then a Democrat, he would later switch parties, but then a Democrat, he filibustered for 24 hours and 18 minutes in opposition to the Civil Rights Act of 1957.
Oh.
Yeah, I think he found himself on the right side of history there. He rambled on about a variety of inane topics, including sharing his grandmother's recipe for biscuits, so perhaps inspired the whole recipe thing in this episode. And in what must be the most anticlimactic closing line in history, Thurmond concluded his filibuster by declaring, "I expect to vote against the bill."
So we start off the episode with CJ writing her her letter to her dad, but it's only later that we find out that there's going to be this structure of everybody writing. In Act Two, Sam takes over, and then in Act Three, we get the part that you were talking about with
By the way, and I'm not
criticizing. We know
criticizing. No, and this is something that Aaron is very open about. But I think Aaron's admiration and sort of aspiration to fill his father's example in shoes is a real reason that he became a writer. I think this comes from, I think he really kind of idolized his dad, who was a very successful
big boy. And his father passed away recently. So
oh, I didn't know that.
Bernie Sorkin, he was an incredible a man and very, very warm to me always in my friendship with Aaron.
Well, rest in peace.
It's interesting that the structure is writing to parents when this family connection is also really essential to the plot of the episode, jumping all the way to the end when it's revealed that the reason why Stackhouse is doing this filibuster is because he's talking about his grandchild, that it comes from a personal connection with autism, that the structure also weaves that in, that the family is this thing that's constant, you're constantly present in your life even when you're working on these political issues.
Right.
I always consider this episode the Stackhouse filibuster, parentheses, how's Grampy? Doesn't mean I want to leave.
Well, just to get things moving again. one thing I know from living in Aaron's writing, I think what he's doing in the most moving episodes is the personal is reverberating off whatever the political stuff. Boy, I said that badly.
Well, ultimately, maybe we should save it for the when we really get deep in. But that one of the things that strikes me about this episode is that there's a great scene with you and George Coe, who played Senator Howard Stackhouse. Ooh, I don't usually get names right. George Coe, by the way, this is his first of three West Wing episodes. You might recognize him as Dustin Hoffman's boss in Kramer versus Kramer. He was in the original Company of the Sondheim musical. It's a musical, Rishi. The show Company. Anyway, there's a wonderful scene where you end up going to his office. You've clearly, in your Josh Lyman way, been just not paying any attention to him. And
God, f*** you.
No, look. Josh, look, my sense in this episode, Josh senses a win. He's on the very verge of it, and he doesn't even want to deal with Stackhouse.
Right.
And you even, I don't remember the exact language, but you basically say,
dismiss it.
Yeah.
Let's play it.
It's 0.8% of a bill aimed at health issues affecting children, which is roughly the same as the percentage of children affected by autism.
I don't need to tell you that in these negotiations...
In these negotiations about a bill aimed at health issues affecting children, we've allocated funds for Alzheimer's, glaucoma, and erectile dysfunction.
Sir.
You know a lot of two-year-olds afflicted with that horrific condition, do you?
There's no doubt that that's a good point, but in order for us to ensure that more important things were in the bill...
So there was a determination made.
I'm sorry?
A determination was made, an order of priorities.
Senator, there's going to be a vote. The bill's closed.
Open it back up again.
To do that would mean to postpone the vote and... Everyone's breaking for the recess and...
And you want the story before everyone goes home?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sir, the next time around, and there will be a next time around.
That's all. I'm done with you now.
And that was that.
So one of the points I was hoping to make is that he lays out a fantastic argument. It's reasoned, it's thoughtful, and that ultimately is not effective. he doesn't make progress on the issue based on merit as much as the personal at the end. And it comes down to the fact that you guys, because of Donna, recognize the personal link that he's got a grandchild with autism. And one of the really interesting things I think about this episode is that the personal and the political, and whom do you know, and do you know their story, and can you empathize beyond people that you know? And
yeah, I had really mixed feelings about, like, all of a sudden the president goes, he didn't tell me the kid has autism. I mean, we would have taken care of this. You know, I was like, that's kind of moving and wonderful, but it's not the way we should be dealing with children's health issues.
Yeah. Well, even just the idea of this $6 billion bipartisan healthcare bill focused on children, isn't that quaint?
Yeah. Yeah. What, it just makes them lazy, you know?
Every time I watch this episode, that's always been an issue for me, too, is that it takes the fact that he's a grandparent in order to convince them that it's worth doing.
It does show, I think, sort of realistically a version of what people in the White House have to deal with in terms of choices, which trying to find a way to relate to it is kind of the way you get requests for donations for money and you know, and you're like, children's cancer trash, you know, I'll do this one, you know, there's this kind of heartless prioritization, which part of which is necessary but is kind of chilling.
I wonder whether personal connections will come into play in the next administration.
I don't think so.
Leo even lays out this line in terms of the personal connection. He says,
because he doesn't want to make political hay out of his grandson, which is commendable.
Which is commendable, but then that is exactly what the president does.
Right. No, that's actually fascinating. Stackhouse doesn't want to do it. He wants to lay out his argument, but it happens all inverts and happens really because of the personal, and it's Bartlett and its administration makes hay out of it.
And it's really Donna who kind of saves the day. As much as the conflict of the episode is set into motion because of Josh stonewalling him despite the merits of the argument, ultimately it's Donna who comes to the rescue because she recognizes, somehow miraculously manages to figure out that because there's, he says, 7 grandchildren, but there's only 6 in the picture, that means she deduces that one of them has autism, and that's why he's filibustering.
She is so good.
She's smart. That was really gross.
She has some great moments, though. She's the hero for that reason, I think, in this episode, but she also explains once and for all to everybody what's going on with your guys' relationship. She says,
yes, sir, but Josh does, and he likes to explain things, and, well, I let him. I'm pretty sure it's true, sir.
This is the exposition episode. Everybody's just telling you this is exactly what's happening.
Should we do some subplots?
Sure.
There are many of them. I like the dinner scene between Leo and Bartlett. So there's a little, I want to play just a little clip, because there's a time where they're just both in frame and they're saying names of haute cuisine French food, and it struck me as like really niche pornography. Older men.
This is in Leo's office, right? When the president comes in?
Yeah. Older men saying French dishes to each other.
This is what I think of when we do Blue Apron ads.
Cassoulet, duck with green olives,
yeah.
Tomate du Saltimbique.
A big seedless beefsteak tomato stewed for 3 hours in creme de caramel and stuffed with
passion fruit, kiwi and hazelnuts, and
served on a pomegranate reduction, yes.
Okay, when we
Does
do
anyone
it,
have a cigarette?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
It's not that sexy when we do it.
But what's really hilarious about this fetishistic rococo, you know, inlet that we're stuck in is, if you know Aaron, I remember I invited Aaron over to dinner, and he's like, oh, yeah, great. What are we going to have? Which is an odd, usually people go, oh, great, you know. And I said, I think I'm going to grill salmon. He goes, oh.
I'm busy that night.
And if you know Aaron, Aaron's, you know, like, if he was going to be executed, he'd want a ding-dong and some yoo-hoo and, you know, maybe a bologna sandwich. He's the opposite of a foodie.
Well, I want to play now the second clip. We know that when Leo and Bartlett finally get to dinner, it's set in a very romantic fashion with candles. And Leo and Bartlett share a moment. And then I'll tell you, I think I know the inspiration for this.
They thought I was going to be eating with Abby, so we'll just, you know, pretend there's no candlelight. That we're not paranoid homophobes in any way.
Yeah.
I watched this and I said that, okay, this happened to me and Aaron. Very early on, we visited, we were in California at the same time. I think I was auditioning for A Few Good Men, the movie. And yeah, I booked the role. 5 words, 3 of them yes, 2 of them sir. And he and I, how shall I say this? We partook of something that at the time was illegal, but soon in California will be legal. And then we were gonna go out to dinner and we got in the car. Well, that doesn't sound right. We got an Uber, which had been invented already.
Kids, yeah.
And he started to obsess about our going out to dinner together. And I was like, what's the problem? He's like, I don't know, it seems gay. I was like, it seems like we're gay? He's like, well, we're two men having dinner. I was like, dude, two men have dinner a lot. And the conversation was concluded back at home where we ordered pizza. So I watched this and I was like, okay, at least he knows how insane he was being.
You guys are like the Jewish Cheech and Chong.
This was a long time ago.
My favorite food-related thing to this for this episode, I think, is some emails that I got from you, Josh, where you kept calling it the steakhouse filibuster.
It's autocorrect.
That's what I thought.
Evoke, invoke, steakhouse, steakhouse.
I thought you were doing it because you had no idea what the name of the episode was. And you really wanted a steak.
There's another food. We know that Sam is on a search for food.
That's right.
During the episode. And his little subplot, right? He comes into a meeting of yours and you end up assigning him.
Yeah, the fruit thing.
Right. So here's what occurred to me. I think, follow me on this. We all know that famously that Lin-Manuel Miranda took many, yeah, lots. He's a huge West Wing fan and he's a friend of the podcast. And he took there are a lot of West Wing references in Hamilton. And he took specific inspiration from a Sam Seaborn line in the U.S. Poet Laureate, mm-hmm. right? Episode in season 3, where Sam, speaking of what he's, in terms of a president, he's yeah. looking for a mind at work.
The first thing he looks for is a mind at work.
Right. So I thought, what if he had taken inspiration from a Sam line in this episode?
I'm looking for a piece of fruit.
It could have gone a whole different way.
Very different.
Looking for a piece of fruit, 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 fruit. Fruit, fruit. Everyone. Fruit, fruit. Fruit, fruit. That's all we've got time for. Hamilton could have been a very different show.
That does take place in the greatest city in the world, the Big Apple.
Fruit joke. You know, I get a lot of feedback that I make dad jokes. Guess what? I'm a dad. Right? What do you want? Niece jokes? Wouldn't make sense. That's a dad joke. Shut up.
I'm sorry.
Another subplot, there's this one.
You're an intern.
Yes.
What are you, 14 years old?
I'm 19 years old.
And what's your problem with my cutting reports?
Nothing, other than being utterly bogus.
What's your name?
Winifred Hooper.
Should I call you Winnie?
Not unless you want me to spit at you.
And I don't.
Okay.
Winifred, the accounting office tells me I can save the taxpayers $3 million by cutting 400 reports.
Now, every American family can realize their dream of a college education for their children with the penny and a half you just saved them.
Okay, you know what?
You blow through these things like they don't mean anything.
They don't mean anything.
You're an idiot.
Okay, so before we even see this scene, we hear about it from CJ. CJ says...
Hey, did I hear you got spanked by some 14-year-old kid interning at the GAO?
Here's my question. When they have that exchange, there's nobody else in the room, which means that the only person who's spreading that rumor must be Sam himself.
It's a very good point.
That intern is played by...
She's great.
Cara Delizia.
So good. By the way, I noticed her character name, Winifred Hooper, I think foreshadowing Danica McKellar's eventual...
Winifred Cooper.
Winnie Cooper, yeah, exactly.
I think that scene is a great example of Aaron's true belief in one of the sort of messages of the show and one of the things that Democrats have not emphasized enough, so that now we have somebody who would get kicked out of a preschool is going to be president, is the whole arguing against the whole notion that government is inherently bad. And she makes very specific, compelling points that these abstract, dismissible issues have real consequences in people's lives. And it's also an interesting... Thank you.
Specifically in terms of waste, too, because government is bad. Even more specifically, people say government is wasteful. They spend money unnecessarily. And so even in a more pointed way, they're talking about how to cut down on spending by not having to create so many reports. But it turns out they're actually really crucial here.
Right, right. It also, I think, is a really good example of what I know you're very aware of in the Josh and Donna dynamic, which is unconscious sexism. And Sam is very dismissive of her, but she really flips it around. I think in the same way Donna does it with me. I'm saying it was intentional to be played as perhaps objectionable.
The last time that Brad joined us on the podcast, Josh had texted him to try and get him to do the episode, and Brad wrote back, Josh showed me the message later, that he would do it, but only if Rishi stops his jihad against Josh and Donna.
Because he's racist, too.
Speaking of which, there's a guy named Zach who's Indian in this episode. And I was like, oh, Zach, I don't know that Indian name. This guy who, when Donna makes the discovery about the incredible deductive leap about Stackhouse's grandchildren is autistic, she says, Zach, will you pull up that B-roll? And it's a guy named Shishir Kurup. And I realized that I'm starting to turn...
You guys are great with technology.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's our show, folks.
Look, there's one computer up here, and it's in front of one person.
Wait, now I just want to really quickly tell our anecdote from last night. Rishi and I went to a great event here, and then we were walking down the street, and somebody approached us and asked for money. We each gave him a little money, and as we walked away, the guy said, ah, an Indian and a Jewish fellow. And we said, speak well of our people.
But I realized that I'm starting to turn into what my parents were when I was a kid. It used to mortify me when we'd go to the grocery store or the mall, and they would get really excited in the 80s when they would stop me and point out whenever we would see other Indian people in the parking lot. They'd say, Bharat Lok, which means Indian people.
My parents did that with us. No, I'm kidding.
But she meant it, they meant it out of fear.
I just got that. God, you're awful.
But now I have the same reaction watching TV, especially older TV. I'm like, Zach, he's actually that's an Indian guy.
Right.
Although the woman who plays Bonnie, Devika Parikh, she's half Indian, I think, right? So it's not like the first Indian sighting in
right.
the West Wing history.
Sighting. God, that's chilling.
It means a lot to my people.
Toby Hoynes?
Yes. This is one of my favorite... This is just a classic line, one of my favorite lines.
Toby, the total tonnage of what I know that you don't could stun a team of oxen in its tracks.
Toby gets entirely pwned, as the kids say, by Hoynes in this episode. It's kind of fun to watch. It's rare that you see people truly set Toby back in his heels and get the better of him, and it just happens kind of over and over again.
But what one of my favorite moments in the show, and just part of the reason I love...
Oh, you love the show? So that's not the sense I'm getting.
Part of the reason I love Richard's acting is when he says, I'm going to shove those papers up your ass, and Toby, you know, it's one of the rare moments you see Toby just go... He just bursts out laughing.
Would you mind if I prepared some notes for you?
Well, not at all. Would you mind if I shoved them up your ass?
Which, by the way, to Aaron is like saying mother. I mean, to say he's so. I'll shut up. He's not.
No, well, it was Sam starts his email to his dad, dear jackass, and then he changes it to dear dad.
And now we're gonna take a quick break. And now back to the show. That Hoynes line felt like a good channeling of Otter, too. His laugh into his ha ha ha.
Yeah, yeah, that's
Vice President Otter.
Actors love that they're trapped in roles from like
20 years ago.
I do like that often we are first introduced to a vice presidential scene, a Hoyne scene. He's always like hosting a group of people. It's like the USC women's volleyball team, or here it's just some older quilting ladies.
Yeah. This is the best, like, most insincere line of the episode. Thank you.
Thank you. Beautiful quilts.
Thank you very much.
He's not even paying attention to them. He's talking to his staff about
water.
About the flooding that happens. And then in the middle of it, he's like, oh, beautiful quilts.
Just the title of my memoir.
I used to say about Tim Matheson that he was a heartbeat away from a regular.
Oh, that's funny.
I like that that got more outrage than all the racist stuff you said. There's some really sweet stuff in the episode as well. This line I love.
Hey, Sam, who's your favorite writer?
Toby.
Oh. That's it.
That's all.
And then it turns out Dickens is his favorite novelist or author, and Stackhouse is reading the entirety of David Copperfield into the record as part of his filibuster. And on the day that I met my now wife of 20 years, she and I had both just finished reading David Copperfield, which is one of the reasons why I was instantly smitten with her.
Oh. Is that another thing that Aaron stole
from
your life?
Shut up, Brad, whatever you're about to say. Also, this my favorite line or moment of the entire episode. Can you play clip 14?
Josh Lyman, everybody.
It's just Brad getting tepid applause. I was like Abby Bartlett. I just kept rewinding and playing and rewinding and playing.
There's structurally, there's something kind of like a callback to the pilot in this episode, because it's not until after the 30-minute mark that you even see the president. The first 30 minutes of the episode go by, and he doesn't make an appearance. It's not until the food porn scene.
Right. An odd entrance.
But so, again, this structure of... it starts with CJ doing her exposition, and then in Act 2, we come in, we see Sam playing solitaire, and then he takes over the voiceover with his letter writing. And then the third act starts, like you said, kind of just out of the blue with your voiceover, and we don't know who you're addressing, and we just hear this.
So I headed up to the hill, wearing, by the way, the new shoes you bought me, which I'd never worn before.
I'm glad we didn't rush by that. It's one of the great pratfalls.
By the way, that is, like, people always say, like, what are your favorite moments from the show? And either the coffee falling out of my mouth.
Brilliant.
Which I'm very proud of. But I love, and Aaron does this a lot, but I love that moment so much.
How many times did you have to do that? It is brilliantly executed. Did you have to find it? You're not really going to do it, are you?
Wow.
You may briefly take your phones out.
He's turning a corner.
Wow. He's still got it, folks.
Yeah. That's a lot more commitment than I was.
So did it
expecting.
Not take, how many takes did it take?
It took a bunch. You know, we did a couple of takes. I think I had little hockey pads on my butt, which I wish I'd worn here.
Did that hurt?
Is he leaving?
Rishi just gave up on. Hey, look, an Indian.
Funny, they told me to wait in the lobby.
Boom.
I do want to say, moments like that, Aaron, it's so funny. It's so silly. It takes the air out of everything. It humanizes things. I love moments like that. I love, there's another moment where for no reason I walk in and go, where's my wallet? You know, and it just flies in.
I love that.
I love his sort of mischievous desire to disrupt like that.
I agree with you. I tend to watch his shows as comedies that deal with very dramatic issues. I feel
Like
he's a very, very funny writer, and it's always there, and it blends well. It does, things don't feel tonally to be shifting,
I used to always say it's very weird when you're an actor, because you're either doing a comedy where there's this artificial relentless need to be funny all the time or you're doing a drama which is an hour of irony deficiency. And Aaron's writing was this wonderful mix of it. It was interesting because I always felt like doing A Few Good Men, the play played much more comically than the film. Did you think that?
So you didn't enjoy Tom Cruise's performance?
Not a criticism.
It's just you didn't think he was funny.
No.
The play was riotously funny. It was a comedy.
It was a comedy.
In its way.
Okay.
One of the...
I think Tom Cruise.
Doesn't mean this has to be.
No.
There's one part that I think is unintentionally funny. I feel bad saying this, but there's after Stackhouse agrees to yield the floor for the question and everybody erupts into cheers, should go back and watch when Donna is clapping afterwards. It's so painfully awkward. It might be because she's holding a pen, but she puts her hands together in a way that I've never seen anyone clap.
I can't wait to watch
this. This is the kind of analysis that will destroy creativity.
I'm not saying I didn't enjoy it.
No, you...
Just for all the wrong reasons.
Yes.
Like a lot of people go on The Bachelor. I wanted to mention a thing, now that you mentioned the filibuster itself, one of the great things about George Coe's performance as Stackhouse is that he's wonderful in that scene with Brad. He's wonderful. No, as is Brad. But the majority of his performance is on C-SPAN, on little televisions, and it's still very moving. The endurance feat, and then once we learn why he's doing it, I'm very moved, even though it's a grainy little screen within a screen. That's powerful.
And the exhaustion in his voice is so palpable at the end when he finally does yield the floor, especially in comparison to the scene earlier when he has a confrontation with Josh.
Somebody pointed that out to me, someone on Twitter, Todd Bernstein? Not Todd Bernstein, clearly, but... Aaron likes to show...
Are you trying to filibuster the podcast?
I was trying to connect with another Jew. Somebody on Twitter pointed out to me that in the pilot of Sports Night, it's all about a group of people rooting for somebody on a little television. It's a recurring Sorkin trope.
That's
of
true.
Being moved by what's on TV.
Trope's not condescending, Aaron.
Help.
The crazy thing about the letter writing exposition structural thing is that they start off writing letters to each of their intended recipients, but then by the end of the episode, somehow they're all writing the exact same letter. Let me just play this.
That is funny.
There'll be no vote tonight, and the Senate will go home for weeks.
And Stackhouse, with our help, blew the print deadline anyway. There's really no reason
for Josh not to go back to the conference chairman and reopen the bill.
The only thing I could think was that senior staff are like women who start to cycle together. You start to write the same letter telepathically together.
Rishi!
You spend enough
time. Why don't we just CC all our parents and write one email? It'll save time.
I know, I was watching that and I was thinking, did I have to loop the whole letter? Or, and then they made the choice? That's probably what they did. We probably all... did it and never questioned it.
I noticed a shot too. I should have the time code, but I do not. Go look early on. CJ's writing her email.
I love the old email format.
I know.
It
looks so ridiculous.
Yeah.
Anyway, she's writing the email, and what we're hearing in voiceover is not what's on her screen. What's on her screen is going to come like 40 minutes later. So if you look, you can kind of see where it's going. And they just took a shot from later.
Cara Delizia, by the way, the intern, I was remembering the only other thing that I've ever seen her in. I don't know if you guys remember this or saw this. I saw it on YouTube. She's in a Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen sleepover video. And there was kind of a...
Yeah, it was so creepy when Bartlett and Leo were fetishizing about food. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Well, this is a... It's a food song, actually. There's a thing where they have a song called "Gimme Pizza," and they're ordering pizza, and then somebody slowed down these children singing to be like normal adult speed, and it sounds like they're just jonesing for crack.
Do you have it?
Give us pizza. P-I-C-C-A. Now I'm feeling kinda hungry. We got mega munchies. Time to make a pizza.
It was a thing. There was a reason for it.
I don't like seeing young Olsen twins because I just always think those guys could buy me and sell me 1,000 times over. Makes me feel bad about myself. Shut up.
You don't need the Olsen twins to feel bad about yourself.
You're not wrong. But it helps. This is usually the point where we go, you have anything else?
Yeah. You got anything else?
Oh, no, you don't.
But I'm agreeing that this is that point.
Thanks for confirming, because I wasn't sure if that's what we did. Brad, do you have anything else? Do you have any specific memories about shooting this episode other than the fall?
You know, it's funny because I really have not... I had seen this episode. I have not seen them all because it's creepy to watch. But I had seen it before. I remember this was a kind of really... what episode is this?
17.
The Stackhouse filibuster.
No. No, but it was number 17, and it was kind of a wonderful time where you felt like it was a good time during the show. It was before you came on. I watched this show. Allison Janney is so stinking good. She's so funny in the Oval Office, like, you know, with Charlie when she blows. I kept thinking that this will sound corny, but like just seeing Janelle, seeing Donna, I was like, oh my God, I just was so in love with her. Character.
You heard it here.
But yeah, Janney's a freak. I may have said this before on the show, but she does this instinctive thing that is, when there's a serious scene, she finds the comedy. When there's a comic scene, she plays it viciously seriously.
Does she ever get it just right?
She's not able to achieve the various shades of beige that you are able to bring.
Brad has described my acting as a single layer cake.
Well, and I don't know if this has ever been on the pod, but I love Josh. I actually think he's a great actor, and I love him forever because he, and I'm not exaggerating, if Richard got a note, you know, it would become a discussion. If I got a note, it would often become a discussion, and anytime any director has ever said anything to Josh, he says, I don't care.
By the way, directors and crews love me.
One thing about Allison Janney in this episode.
Also, a single layer cake is still cake.
There's a great dynamic running through the series that's kind of a little bit low-key, which is the CJ-Charlie dynamic that I think is so awesome. We've talked about it a little bit. There's a scene a little while ago where just passing through in front of his desk to go to the Oval Office, she like gives him a high five. And they just have these little moments. Sometimes they're
yeah, can I call you Chip?
Blips.
Can I?
Yeah, exactly.
CJ. Charlie.
Listen.
May I call you Chip?
No.
Chipper?
No.
Gilligan?
Listen.
Yes?
And again, I love this about Aaron and Aaron's writing that he has, there's this, you know, he's writing this stuff fast and there is this recklessness to it and sense of play in the midst of, you know, really high stakes. It's an amazing combination.
It's fun to watch the different permutations of all our heroes. Oh, these two together are funny. These three have their own dynamic. And
right. I enjoy and it's that. Distinct.
Are you not going to talk about grammar after I mention, don't I say, dangling participle?
Yeah, the dangling modifier.
I'm trying to recover from evoke invoke. But what do you got?
Don't I say dangling modifier in the episode?
Yes.
I thought you might put America to sleep with a discussion. We could say night.
I was
going
to save it for Twitter, but
no. I love your obsession with grammar. I remember Aaron. I remember having a conversation about whether it was grammatically incorrect. I was using me instead of I. And Aaron was like, yep, yeah, I know. Yeah, I want it to sound like that.
Yeah, yeah. There you go. Yeah.
Did that upset you?
Yes. Yeah, I think, attempt to correct my grammar, and then I would get corrected back into what I should really say.
Right.
Do you guys know the SNL sketch, The Californians? I like that there's, throughout the beginning of the episode, there's like a little miniature version of the Californians that's happening.
I'm about to miss the 7:30 shuttle. If I miss the 8:30, I miss the last train to Sag Harbor.
No, I'm saying I already missed the 6:50 to Denver, but I can catch an 8:40 from National if I change planes in Chicago.
I'll take Amtrak to Penn Station and rent a car.
By the way, I just realized, is Toby going skiing? Because I can't imagine that.
That's true. I know that wherever Sam is going, it's a Tommy Hilfiger ad, but I was thinking, like, when is it not a Tommy Hilfiger ad for him?
By definition. No, you're right.
Yeah. Well, I think we're going to start to wrap up here.
Aww.
Thank you so much for joining us.
This has been so much fun.
If you want to discuss this episode, you can talk to us in the lobby, or you can leave a comment for us on our website if you're very shy, thewestwingweekly.com, or on our Facebook page, facebook.com/thewestwingweekly.
You can and should follow us on Twitter. Just do it now. Take your phones out. At Josh Molina, at Rishi Hirway.
Rishi.
At, what is that?
I'm Rishi Hirway. It's nice to meet you.
It's just H-H-H-H-H and... There's an R and an I. Just follow me on Twitter.
Oh, and also Brad is at Whitford Bradley.
Am I?
And the show is at West Wing Weekly. You can buy merchandise by going to...
Celebrity Lubrication.
That's right. By going to Brad's merch table.
You get
outside.
To keep the bucket.
All that stuff's on our website. We are a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX. PRX, in partnership with Roman Mars, who's here somewhere tonight. Podcast royalty.
Todd Bernstein didn't make it, but we got Roman Mars.
And Helen Zaltzman. We got a bunch of PRX Radiotopia people here, so if you see them, say hi.
And check out the other Radiotopia podcasts. They are all awesome, each in its own way. They're fantastic.
Josh doesn't mean that.
I know he does.
Untrue.
He
actually I listen to them all the time.
And you can find them all at radiotopia.fm. Our show is produced by the two of us, along with Zach McNeese and Margaret Miller. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, guys. If you're looking for another podcast to listen to, check out Normal Gossip from Radiotopia. They're coming back for their sixth season. If you don't already know the show, they were named one of the best podcasts of the year by Time Magazine and Vulture, and their new season starts April 17th. Normal Gossip is really fun. It's a show about petty and ridiculous and strange stories and the way that we share those stories. The stories that they tell in the podcast are sent in by listeners, and then they're anonymized and then retold to a guest. And then they have to weigh in on the decisions that the people in the story are making. It's very funny and very beloved. So if you aren't already listening, check out the new season, which starts April 17th. You can listen to Normal Gossip wherever you get your podcasts.
Radiotopia. From PRX.